about Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Steve Bourne, and he'll be answering your most important questions on fly fishing the hex hatch on Midwestern streams. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Steve a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll try to answer your question at some point during the show and take care of you there. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so that you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and your email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Steve Bourne about fly fishing the hex hatch on Midwestern streams. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. They are involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida, in the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Species Initiative, and is also helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. To continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. Before we introduce Steve, we'd like to let you know about all the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Steve's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Steve's book, Exploring Wisconsin Trout Streams, the Angler's Guide, courtesy of University of Wisconsin Press. So thanks to them for providing that book as a great prize tonight. Here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something we talk about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location in the text box on our homepage. So listen closely, type fast, and maybe you can win Steve's book. Tonight our guest is Steve Bourne. Steve was associated with the University of Wisconsin from 1969 until his retirement in 2005, where he was a professor of urban and regional planning and environmental studies. He has served as the chair of Department of Urban and Regional Planning in the University of Wisconsin-Madison Graduate Water Resources Management Program. Steve has been a principal in the development of Wisconsin laws for lake and watershed management, groundwater protection, and land use planning and mineral development. He has served as the chairman of the National Resources Board of Trout Unlimited USA and has also served on the board of directors for the River Alliance of Wisconsin, Thousand Friends of Wisconsin, Trout Unlimited Canada, Henry's Fork Foundation, and the Black Earth Creek Watershed Association. Steve has fished extensively across the western two-thirds of the U.S. for more than four decades. Idaho's Henry's Fork, most of Montana's famous rivers, Yellowstone National Park, Alaska, Wyoming, and Colorado have been his major fishing haunts, and wild trout have been his favorite targets. Steve has also spent many years chasing trout in New Zealand and Patagonia, and he's also fished the shallow salt waters of the Bahamas, Costa Rica, Belize, Mexico, and Florida for tarpon, bonefish, and permit. But his favorite waters are his home waters in the Driftless area of Wisconsin. Steve, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
It's great to be back with you, Roger.
Good, good. Well, this will be fun to talk about because I've been wanting to do a show on the hex hatch for a long time. So I'm looking forward to this. And so we have lots to talk about. So let's just dive right in here, Steve, and take some of these questions and see if we can't give people a better picture of what the hex hatch is all about. So let's just start, you know, at the beginning when people get all excited about the hex hatch. So what makes the hex hatch so exciting?
Well, it's 7 months away from fulfilling that excitement for me right now, but the hex are such big flies. They're the 747s of the insect world. And really, the only big fly hatches that we get a chance to fish over that even come close to the hex hatch are the salmon flies out west and the green drakes east and west. But those hatches lack the magic. They don't take place at pitch black in the nighttime. You're not lost in swamps. You're not being attacked by hordes of mosquitoes. You don't have problem aggressive muskrats. You don't have a bat on the end of your line. Clearly, as you can see, the hex hatch is probably not for everyone. It's kind of an acquired taste. So for some, it may be intimidating, but for others, it's really magical. And for those who are hex addicts, and I noticed from a few of the comments and questions that came in beforehand, there are a few hex addicts on the line tonight. It's probably the most anticipated hatch of the season. It brings up the big fish. And I might just note that it's not just trout, which we're talking about tonight, but those folks who fish lakes and rivers in southern areas, the hex hatch there will bring up bass, walleye on top, even carp. So it's a heck of an experience for bringing up the big fish. I might tell you, you ask, you know, what makes it so exciting? Let me tell you about my first experience, Roger.
Okay.
I moved back here. I lived on the Truckee River in Nevada and fished all over the West at that point. Came back and was totally unimpressed with these little tiny cricks running through cow pastures. But some good fishing friends of mine said I had to experience the hex hatch, whatever that was. And they picked me up one evening and drove me about an hour and a half north of Madison, where I live, dropped me off at a bridge along a slowly meandering stream wandering through some mucky swampland, pointed me in a general direction, and said they'd be back to pick me up later. I put on my gear, headed into this Vietnam-like swamp for about 300 or 400 yards. Got there, was sweaty, it was hot, mosquitoes were all over the place, and finally I started hearing a couple of fish slurping around, and there must have been one kamikaze fish of about 9 inches that sacrificed himself and ate a fly. By that time it was about 11 o'clock, and pitch black, I made my way out, got to the bridge, sweaty beyond belief, and nobody was there. And I began concluding that these fellows had just taken me on a snipe hunt. Finally, about an hour later, they came by and picked me up, and they were all congratulating each other about what a great night it was, and I vowed I'd never do this again.
It sounds like they gave you the best spot. Right.
As you're
not.
Pals always do.
Yeah. So did they take you back again and treat you right?
Well, I fished with them subsequently, but someplace along the line, I drank the Kool-Aid, and now I fish hatch between 30, 35 nights a summer.
Oh, wow. Wow. Well, tell us about the hex itself. What kind of insect are we talking about here?
Well, as I implied, we're talking about a real big one. It has a lot of aliases. In some places, it's called the Michigan caddis, which is a total misnomer, or a sandfly, or the big yellow mayfly. Or a fish fly. In fact, around the Great Lakes, around Erie and Huron, they call it the Canadian soldier. But the message here is that they're big. The nymph body is, up to an inch and a half, and on the adults, the wingspan can be on the order of 2 inches. There's about, 5 or 7 species of hex, depending upon what kind of taxonomist you are and if you split or lump. But the most prolific and the most widespread in North America is Hexagenia limbata. That is the one I think the most hex fishermen focus on, although there are a couple of other species that are important depending upon what locale you're in. These are burrowing mayflies. They're found in slow water, lazy rivers, backwater areas, marl-rich or silty bottom lakes, and they burrow into the silt, mud, and marl bottoms. And that sediment has to be strong enough, cohesive enough, to support these U-shaped burrows in which these nymphs are going to live for the next couple of years. You can find them all over the country, really. They range from the east, Pennsylvania, New York, New England, Virginia, eastern Canada, Ontario. The Great Lakes, as I mentioned, have huge hatches. And then on out west to where there's some very famous hatches. California has the Fall River, Oregon, the Williamson, the whole Pacific Northwest up into British Columbia and down as far as Texas and northern Mexico. But it's this upper Midwest area, really, Wisconsin, Michigan, Minnesota, that really is the centerpiece of the classic hex fishing waters.
Do you know if they're found outside North America, or is it strictly a North American insect?
No, I don't know. I tried to do a Google search on that, and I do know that a lot of their prehistoric relatives dating back several hundred million years are found in sediments in Europe and other places, but I don't know whether or not other continents experience the hex hatch.
Yeah, yeah. I know when we were doing a show on dragonflies, we were talking about the fossils of the ancient dragonflies, and I guess those back then had something like 3-foot wingspans or something like that. Just incredible, you know? But I wonder how big the mayflies were way back when. I mean, I wonder if they had like 2-foot wingspans or something.
You needed a really big hook back then.
Yeah. Well, the fish were really big back then, too, I guess. So, but anyway, yeah. So what is the life cycle of the hex, and how does that affect our fishing?
Well, let me just note for perhaps some of your listeners, I know some of the folks who are on the line are probably in the Midwest, but some of the real fabled rivers, the ones you hear about, the Osable in Michigan, the Pere Marquette, the Manistee, here in Wisconsin, the Brule, the Namekagon, the McCann, the Strait River up in Minnesota. These are the ones you hear about, but those are just the featured rivers. There are Hexagenia and many, many rivers in this part of the country. In terms of the hatch, we have to distinguish between kind of the seasonal hatch timing and the hatch cycle itself on a diurnal basis or daily basis. Typically, the hex hatch starts in most places in early to mid-June and can run all the way through as a startup point until mid-August or so. It's typically controlled by water temperature, but it can be quite variable from place to place. In some of the Rocky Mountain higher country where it occurs, or in some of the Oregon Cascade Lakes, the event happens much, much later. They're unbelievable hatches. The Mississippi River drainage has just incredible hatches. You can find on YouTube a Doppler weather radar event that captures a huge hatch extending from Iowa up to Minnesota along the Mississippi that shows up on their weather radar. In places, river towns like La Crosse and Prairie du Chien, sometimes there's so much biomass that they really have to bring out, and I'm not joking, the snowplows to scrape the slippery mass of bugs off the bridges. And in places like Lake Erie, Lake Huron, lots of places where you have bright lighting, there'll be a pile up to nuisance proportions of these bugs. And the entomologists find, you know, more than 500 nymphs per square foot. And there are some guys who have gone around and estimated there's 1 million nymphs per acre in the Mississippi River, which, needless to say, produces some pretty amazing hatches and spinnerfalls. So that gives you kind of a general overview. In terms of their daily life cycle, they're like other mayflies or ephemera. These guys go through an incomplete life cycle, you know, from eggs to nymphs to the dun and the spinner. There's no pupal stage. And the nymph is a big guy. He can be, they say, up to 1.5 inches long. They're real prominent gills. And these things, you'll see them in bait shops in the Midwest where they're called wigglers. They're used for ice fishing and very common bait. And, of course, there are some states that have limited the harvesting of these nymphs for baits because it's damaged the bug hatch. They live for usually about 2 years, but it could be 1 to 3 years, living in these U-shaped tubes of theirs in the mud. And they'll molt as they grow maybe 30 times as they move towards adulthood. Their burrows, 6 inches into the bottom mud. But they're available to fish from time to time as they crawl out and look around for food and detritus. And steelhead anglers here in the Midwest in the fall often use Hexagenia nymphs, imitations, wigglers in their fishing. So they know they're around. But in early, typically when the hatch starts, you might see a few flies early in the evening, 7 o'clock or something like that, but the real hatch doesn't start, if it's going to start, until about sunset. One of your questioners beforehand asked about are any biological or phenomenological signals that the hatch might be coming. And some of the old-timers, when I first started fishing the hex hatch, told me about watching for the blooming of the peonies back here, or watching the June bugs, which you're crunching on as you walk along, when they pretty much run their course, the hex hatch might be starting. But back here, it typically starts early June, once in a while the last of May, sometimes a little later, depending upon what happens.
Yeah, that was Larry Hall in Indian River, Michigan, that had asked that question. So you have to, starting at the beginning of June, you just start going out, you know, every so many nights and see what's happening until it starts. Is that your process?
You have an idea where the hex banks, the sediment that might hold the nymphs are. Oftentimes, where they're really thick, you can see little holes in the sediment, which are the tops of their burrows. And so you know they're there, and you have to keep trying to find that magical event. When it starts, the nymphs, they're pretty good swimmers with their gills. They'll kind of use an undulating movement to swim to the surface, and then they struggle like crazy to get out of their nymphal shucks. They may spend minutes trying to get out, and of course they're very vulnerable there. And then the duns themselves, which are just absolutely glorious insects, big, an inch and a half, maybe 2 inches from the end of their tails to the head, they can be quite variable in color. They're typically kind of yellowish, brownish, olivish, little purple tinge. They've got the grayish, heavily veined, very clearly veined wings. And these duns will struggle and struggle to get off the water and to dry their wings. And it's an amazing food frenzy. What you see is the cedar waxwings, the red-winged blackbirds, the bats. They are onto these bugs before the fish, and you hardly see a bug lift off the water or splash around a little bit on the water before it's grabbed by one of these competitors for food. And I'll tell you, Roger, from time to time, I've just wondered whether or not there's any bugs left over for the fish. But they hatch in such prodigious numbers, as I indicated, that's the way they make it. So after they finally get off the water and survive, they drift into the vegetation for 1 or 2 days, trying to hide from any kind of predators before they get to their final transformation. And then they crawl out of their skin one last time and become a spinner or the mature imago stage. And there they look very much like the duns, but the wings are transparent now. And they've got real long tails and a very bright body, and sometimes you can see the egg sacs in them. And at this point, they're sexually mature. And the only thing left for these guys to do now is to procreate. So they go through an aerial mating, and then there's these just absolutely incredible egg-laying spinner flights as they move upstream. I've had it happen where I've been standing in a stream, and things have been pretty dull, and you start hearing a low hum, and you're wondering whether or not you might be under some power lines, and then pretty soon little helicopters are bumping into your face and rod, and you realize you're in the middle of this massive spinner flight, hoping that it will drop to the water someplace near you. So that gives you some idea of how magical that hatch can be.
Yeah, that's great. Well, let's take a quick break here, Steve, and when we come back, we'll dig into this more and learn how to best fish this wonderful hatch. Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to this spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com to visit the fishing products and guide services they offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Steve Bourne about fly fishing the hex hatch on Midwestern streams. If you'd like to ask Steve a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Steve, I always ask my guests what's going on in their fly fishing world, so what is going on in your fly fishing world right now?
Well, of course, there's a small thing in my fly fishing world that I'm looking forward to. You and I talked about briefly before we went on tonight. I'm disappearing in a week to try that quest for permit one more time down in Mexico, but that's not what we're really talking about here. We're in the process. Well,
we wish you all the luck, Steve, because you'll need it.
We'll need it, right. As long as they have an adequate supply of tequila, we can make the fishing work.
There you go.
any event, right now we're busy updating our book, Exploring Wisconsin Trout Streams, and making a bunch of changes and new photography and so forth. So that's been a big task, and that's in the spring. And then I've been very much involved working with Trout Unlimited and a number of other nonprofits and local governments and state agencies on a very large stream restoration, dam decommissioning on one of our prime streams, actually my home water near Madison called Black Earth Creek. And that section, several miles of stream, should turn out to be a wonderful place for hex fishing down the road. So that's used up a bunch of time, and that's pretty much what I've been focused on.
Good, good. Well, that sounds like an excellent project to be involved with. And decommissioning some of these dams, you know, is I think is a worthwhile project, and so wish you all the luck with that, too. Well, good. Well, let's, we did get a question in on the Internet. We're taking a break there, and it's Brian in Waterloo, Iowa, and he wanted to know what the best time of year to fish the hex hatch in Iowa, if you know.
Yep. About the same time as Wisconsin, Brian. You start looking in early June, and you may have to make several nights out. You certainly want to know the water you're on and make sure you've got suitable habitat. It could be as late as mid-June. And it's strange over in Iowa. They get these huge hatches at the mouths of a lot of their trout streams in the Driftless area along the Mississippi. But the hex hatch can be short-lived or not known to many people on some of those streams. But there are hex there, and there are good hex hatches. I don't know exactly where you're fishing, but start in early June.
Okay. And then we had another location question from Rich up in Michigan. And he wants to know if you fish hex hatch over there in Michigan.
I have one time, Rich, but I've got a ton of friends that are wedded to fishing the hex in Michigan, and they view themselves as the originators of all that hex fishing. And Rusty Gates up there on the Osalvo, when he was alive, pioneered with lots of fly patterns, and there's so many famous Michigan anglers, Michigan patterns, that it's a great place to fish. But we think we've got just about as good a resource over here with less drive time.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think that's where most people hear about the hex hatch.
Well, it's the kind of thing that if you're an angler and you've never done it, you owe it to yourself. It is a don't-miss trial situation. You may hate it the first time. You may love it. I don't know. But if you're in hex country and at the right time of year in that early summer period and you get an opportunity to go out and try it for a night or two, I can't emphasize, it can change your life. It could wreck your marriage. It could make you a nighttime person. It's kind of funny, Roger. There's up in some of our hex waters in northern Wisconsin, one of the most famous spies in American history, a guy named James Atherton, only fished at night up there, we think presumably a fair amount of the time for hex, and nobody ever saw him. So there's all kinds of strange things that can happen with a hex hatch.
Yeah, yeah, that's for sure. Well, let's talk a little bit about the equipment that you go out there with. Is there anything special as far as rods, lines, reel setups that you do a little differently than your normal daytime fishing?
Not really. We'll talk about tactics, I suspect, in a little while. In terms of gear, the first thing to bring along is mosquito repellent. Did I say bug dope? Mosquito repellent. DEET-based, you are going to be besieged in most of these places where hex are, and you want to make sure you've got some pretty good DEET-based repellent with you, maybe even a net over your head. Lights, you've got to have good lights, and I pluralize that because sure, then heck, if you bring along just one light, it will either fall into the river or the batteries will go dead. I carry three lights with me of different types, one clipped on a hat, another on a band around my neck, and another in a pocket. So lights are really important. And a compass. Now, there's a strange thing, but I spent a night lost in the largest roadless area in Wisconsin, an area I was intimately familiar with, on the coldest night of the year of several summers ago, the Bibbins Swamp. And lacking a compass, we didn't work our way out until morning. So those are just some miscellaneous things you might want to have. In terms of our normal fly fishing gear, a 5 to 7 weight rod is fine, 8 to 9 feet. I have a little 7.5 foot rod, a 5 weight that I like to use from time to time. Floating lines, strictly floating lines. Usually weight forward taper here because you got to turn your flies over. And about a 7.5 to 9 foot leader tapered to a 2 or 3X, sometimes 4X tippet. These fish, once they start gorging on these bugs, are not leader shy. But you need that big leader to turn over these big flies so you can accurately drop your fly where you want at night. And you also have to be able to move these fish out, particularly when you hook a good fish, out from under cover. So typically 2X or 3X tippet size.
Okay, okay. Great, great. And we did, I did post a couple of your photographs on your speakers page. So folks, if you want to go out there, you can see a picture that Steve did of the spinner and also of one of the flies. And we'll talk about that next here. So what patterns have you found to be most effective? Are these your custom patterns? Are there some commercial patterns out there that are popular?
Well, if you really want to learn something about hex and treat yourself to the insanity of fly tying, go on the web and Google tying hex flies. And there are hundreds and hundreds of patterns out there for every stage of the insect. It is a wild assortment. Tires have let their imagination run absolutely wild. Typically, these flies are on sometimes 4, but usually size 6 to 10 hooks. They may be 1 or 2X long, depending upon the sizing. And let me just kind of track through, Roger, what we might typically use as fly patterns for the different stages of the insect. For the nymphs, and we'll talk later about whether or not there's a good opportunity for nymph fishing, there are several things that will work. A Borger strip nymph. Gary Borger developed that fly. It's a very good imitation of the movement of a hex. A wiggle nymph, which is an articulated, very small nymph with a marabou in it. A woolly bugger can be a very effective fly. Even Dave Whitlock's red fox squirrel hair, tied large, maybe with a little longer tail. And there's a host of other nymph-specific patterns that you can see on the web or in any fly pattern book. So that's kind of a basic list of nymphs. As we move towards emergers, and emergers are an important stage of this insect, now, Cauchy and Nasashi's Compara duns, well, the Compara emerger is just kind of a short-winged version of their Compara dun. Bob Quigley's Cripples, which a lot of the Western folks would know and folks who fish the Rocky Mountain area, a modification of the Quigley Cripple. I put some marabou on for a tail and abdomen, and then use a very short wing and a hackle then to just float it. It hangs down into through the film. Gary LaFontaine, the fellow, developed a fly which he called the Mess. Doesn't look like much. Floats right in the film. It can be an effective emerger on occasion. But any kind of short-winged emerger, the pattern that you use of the right size, can be a very effective fly and often is the fly I'll start with. As for duns, I've found great success fishing very simple, durable patterns. One of my favorites would be in the Lee Wolf series of flies, but I use a white wolf and typically a size 6 or 8. And I'll modify it a little bit for my own purposes by putting a couple strands of moose hair in the tail and some antron shuck fibers in the tail. But otherwise, it's that white wolf, and it's been very, very successful for me. Another fly would be Craig Matthews' Sparkle Dun, just tied to proportions with a little bit larger, longer shuck on. You can also put some hackle around that wing and even trim the hackle if you have to. Parachute flies can be dynamite, whether they're with a dub body or a deer hair body or foam bodies. They're excellent, and they can also cross over from time to time and serve not only as a dun imitation, but also as a spinner imitation. And then my friend Dick Berge in northern Wisconsin, a fine fly tire, ties one of the most popular flies used in that part of the world. It's a deer hair bullet head fly, just a wonderful fly. As you move into hex spinners, almost any big spinner pattern with high vis or synthetic wings, hackled to keep it afloat, can work very well. Both for duns and spinners, you can use extended bodies. I happen to like them. The extended body can be made of deer hair or it could be made of foam. The wings could be made of hair, elk hair or even deer hair, calf tail, various yarns. So there's a lot of ways to do extended bodies, and some people swear by extended bodies. And then I have other friends who come in from the hex hatch and say, well, they bumped that extended body and didn't get the fly, so they never got a good hook set on them. One little tip for the fly tires, sometimes I've taken to adding in one or two strands of crystal flash mixed into the tail of both duns. I'll have a couple of duns and a couple of spinners with this little modification, and I think it sometimes separates my fly out from the flock. So that gives you a kind of an overview of the pad that we use in the hex hatch.
Did you see the one that you had in the vise that I put on your speakers page, extended body? Has that got a particular name?
Yep, that's the deer hair bullet head.
Deer hair bullet head, okay. Good.
And it gives you a wing profile that looks like both an adult and looking up from the fish's point of view like a spinner. It's been very good fly.
Good pattern, huh? Good. Well, that gives us a broad overview. Sounds like, as always with the mayflies, a lot of different flies to simulate the different stages.
Yeah.
Brian Adams in Bakersfield, California asked, "Does hex hatches always seem to happen when there's very little light left? Have you ever tried a glow-in-the-dark post for better visibility? Would this spook the fish?"
Yeah, I have. And when that product first came out, I tried it on post, and I actually tried it on bodies. It didn't seem to make any difference, and in a reasonably short period of time, it wore off of the fly because you're casting repeatedly. And I decided the difference wasn't enough to warrant one more thing to fidget around with in pitch black nighttime.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's dig in here a little bit on tactics and strategies to, you know, how do we go about doing this? Obviously, that first experience wasn't too successful for you, so I'm sure you learned a lot since then. How do you, you know, prepare for a night of fishing? Is there any routine you go through?
Yep, there is. It's a great question, and preparation is really critical for this particular hatch. Remember, the hatch usually takes place from sunset into 1 a.m. in the morning. There are exceptions. A lot of people have reported, not me, on overcast, cloudy days, occasionally getting hatches all through the day. I've seen a bug come off now and then in the early afternoon, but I've never seen a full-blown hatch. But some people have said that in inclement weather, they will get a hex hatch during the day. But for the most part, plan on fishing from sunset into the nighttime. So it's a nighttime fishing situation where, as you indicate, preparation is just critical. Safety is a priority as well. You have to get to your fishing area early enough. Whatever reach you've selected, which seems to have all the habitat and structure and so forth that you want, to check out that water, to make sure you know where there are deep holes, where there are snags across the bottom, where there are sinkholes or mud-sucking areas that might entrap you in the evening. We've had friends disappear to their waist in these things and hardly able to get out. So you don't want to take a swim at night and leave your hat floating downstream. You don't want to get hurt. And so your beat might be, for me, I'd say a couple hundred yards at most, and I'll try to be intimately familiar with that stretch of water and the areas I think I'm most likely going to be fishing and any wading hazards that I might encounter. So that kind of preparation pre-hatch makes a lot of sense. Now, in the early hatch period, before the hatch, there are some folks who really like to fish nymphs, and some even on a sinking line. And they'll cast up and across stream, and they'll kind of very slowly drift their nymph through prime lies and over the bottom and beneath undercut banks and so forth. And as you get closer and closer to what might be hatch time, a little bit darker, you might fish your nymphs in a slow strip retrieve, kind of trying to emulate the undulations of the nymph as it's moving around preparing to surface. There are some other anglers, and I'm increasingly in that crowd, who prefer to stay out of the water and simply sit there, watch carefully, wait for the hatch, pay attention to what's going on around you so you can see it when it begins, and not bother fish. Because there are many of these streams that you can stomp through and never kick up a fish in a sand, mucky bottom, for a half a mile, you'll think there aren't any fish in there. But if you stay out of that water and the hex hatch comes on at night and suddenly you find hundreds of fish feeding up and down in front of you, you wonder where they all are. But in my judgment, my preference at least, is to stay out of the water, sit on the bank, and watch and wait until we get closer to hatch time, which is typically 8:45, 9 o'clock in our neck of the woods. The sun is setting. And then I'll move over to a merger of some type usually. And these flies, as I say, are struggling, and the duns are struggling, trying to get off the water. So I'll be fishing those, watching for rising fish. And I'm also keeping an eye open for spinners. Sometimes you don't get these big, loud spinner flights that I described. They'll just suddenly sort of appear on the water, and you don't even hear them hitting the water. And they may be motionless, and they may be twitching. But even though there's duns on the water, the fish may have all moved over and be looking for spinners. It's a kind of a strange event. So that's kind of my strategy. There are some key tips I think I could provide based on lots of years of doing this.
Okay. Well, we did have a couple questions then before we move into those techniques. And I guess one thing, you don't have to worry about fish seeing you, right? So there's really no need to be out in the water, I would think, as long as you can get your casts out. And fish probably come up pretty close when it's dark, right?
It's absolutely true. But even though they can lock in on their food sources, they're still trout. And if you don't wade quietly, if you make inappropriate noise or send up waves, those fish are going to be disrupted. So you still need to be treated like trout fishing, but you have some things working for you at night.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back and talk more about strategies and tactics here for fishing within the hex hatch. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 31 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about the premier shop by logging onto their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Steve Bourne about fly fishing the hex hatch on Midwestern streams. If you'd like to ask Steve a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay. So, yeah, we had two questions, Steve, one from Rich Bauer and one from Corey in New Hampshire. And they had rather long intros to their question, but I'll kind of cut to the chase here. They were both asking basically about fishing nymphs before sunset. In other words, they've been told, and I guess had not much success with this, but going out a few hours before sunset and fishing nymphs at that point in time and not having a great amount of success. What is your experience with that?
Well, I've had a pretty similar experience to those fellows. I've caught a couple nice fish nymphing before the hatch an hour or so before, but I haven't had the kind of success that one might have expected as the nymphs became active and prepared the surface. And so I've made largely the decision to stay on the shore and stay out of the water, or else I might fish starting at 8 o'clock or 8:15. I might throw a little smaller hex emerger across some likely places. But I don't do it a lot because I don't want to disturb these fish. I want to give them a chance to discover that there's food around and to get into a feeding rhythm. So I would not say that I've had great success. I know there are other anglers, and Gary Borger is one, who enjoys nymph fishing the hex hatch. But most of the folks who I have spent time fishing with, by and large, wait for the onset of the hatch.
Okay. So then let's talk about, we've prepared ourselves. We're all safety geared. I assume you also wear helmets and face masks for bats and shin guards for muskrats and things like that, right? Beavers?
All of the above, and we're not joking. I mean, a great hex night would be the trifecta, where you got a bat, a red-winged blackbird, and maybe a muskrat.
Oh, yeah, I read some stories on the Internet, people hooking bats, hooking beavers, and all kinds of stuff. So, yeah, I guess it's not as unusual as you might think. Well, let's talk about the strategy there. So we're out there on the river, starting to get dark. First of all, can you see anything? I mean, can you see enough to target a specific fish? How do you go about that?
Darn good question. One thing that happens as you do this for a while is your senses become much more acute. You are able to see things. Obviously, it's not like daylight, but you're able to discern an awful lot at night, and then sound becomes really important. Your hearing becomes a really important guide on what's going on. I try to take in a few casts beforehand to kind of know what the rod feels like loaded at the distance I might be casting to a log or an undercut bank. I want to have a pretty good idea that I'm not going to be hooking up and tag alders or sticking my fly over on the bank and having to break off and tie on at night. So you can see quite a bit, and early on, just take that preliminary effort to kind of measure distances around you, gauge your cast, look around as to where you want to enter the stream and where you might want to exit the stream, and kind of plan your whole presentation on the expectation that the darn bugs will start to hatch. Now, that, of course, doesn't always happen.
Bummer, huh? Yeah. So you can get all geared up out there, ready to go, and nothing happens, huh? Is it always absolutely nothing, or is there something that happens?
Well, let me give you a little flavor of that, and some of these I'll try to make some points here that might be tips even for experienced hex anglers. The positioning is very important, whether you're on land or in the water. As you indicated, you can get awfully close to these fish if you're careful, and particularly once they're really into gorging on the hex. And so a 30-foot cast would be a long cast. Once in a while, you'll need to shoot up way up. You'll see a fish feeding. But for the most part, they're 20-foot cast. And you've got to be able, and this is where getting close helps, to make a controllable, repetitious drift. Because if there's a number of bugs on the water, you're going to want to try put your bug over that same feeding lane as often as you can, trying to intersect a fish. And getting close has one other advantage, I think, and that is it sets you up to get a good hook set on the fish. A lot of folks have trouble. They keep missing strikes at night. They're a little late, and sometimes it's just they've got too much line out, too much slack, and they're not in a position to set up quickly on a fish. With regard to a strategy for focusing on a fish, I would say this. I would concentrate on a few good fish, and I'd wait until that fish or another fish nearby really got into a feeding rhythm and come up a time or two or three, taking a fly, and you had some measure of the way that fish was eating. Don't flock shoot. Don't start casting willy-nilly out into where there's a lot of rises all over the place in the hopes that somebody will hit. Focus on a fish. And this is where sound really becomes important. You have to be able to distinguish a good fish from a small fish. The sound of a big fish is kind of, it's hard for me to replicate it here. It's a kind of a slurp. It sounds like water going down the bathtub at the end. It's a great, you can hear a lot of water being displaced. And that's typically a big fish taking a dun, while smaller fish are usually associated with a lot of splashy rises, and those 8, 10, 12-inch fish are not what you're out there hex fishing for. There is an exception to that, and this can be very deceptive. Both dealing with emergers and more often with spinners, there can be little sipping rises, and you think, gee, it didn't look like much over there. And you look at it again, it still doesn't look like much. It's a little slow sip and a few little rings. And you put your fly over there, and the next thing you know, you're into a 5-pound brown. So deception, you can be deceived by the nature of the rise form. But for the most part, use your ears, focus on the fish you're after, and that's a much better strategy than just shooting blindly all over the place. Be prepared to fish the tough spots, the difficult spots. A lot of those big fish you'll hear slurping way back under the alders and really tough lies. Many, many years ago, I had broken a leg and was on crutches, and the hex hatch came, and a couple of my friends took me down below a bridge. I only had to go on my crutches a little ways, and I kneeled down, and sooner or later, the hex hatch came on, and there were a couple of good fish feeding way back under these tag alders and making a horizontal cast and kind of skipping the bug back under there. I got 2 20-inch browns in that evening. So you've got to be willing to risk your flies, even though it's such a pain in the neck to have to change flies at night, to get into tough lies. I mean, oftentimes the fish will be out beside a log or beside a stump or next to a bank, but you've also got to be prepared to go where you're hearing big fish rise.
Yeah,
which leads into one other thing, and that is changing flies at night. And it's a tough enterprise in the dark. I don't know how well you fare, but when fish are rising all around in the daytime hatch, I can have trouble tying on a size 18 fly. Hands start to shake a little bit and so forth. Doing it in the pitch black of night with insects all around and fish rising around you, and your light not working as well as you'd like, and your magnifier had eyes clouding over with fog, that becomes a real enterprise. And I've had people I've taken out hex fishing who broke off their fly, and 15 minutes later I hear them cursing as fish were rising all around them, and it's a difficult enterprise. And I've had this trouble myself. What I've tried to do now is to be prepared by having an extra tied on a separate tippet, and I'll have a little loop tied there so I can do a loop-to-loop connection of a new fly. And that expedites things and can really help. So that's another kind of preparation, being ready to change flies. I find I can change from one dun to another dun, but if suddenly the spinners are on the water and I tie on a spinner and I break it off in a fish or something happens, it can be really difficult. And oftentimes the hatch is not going to last too long. And if you spend a lot of time goofing around putting on another fly, the hatch is over.
Yeah. Sounds like a dilemma.
Well, you asked about, sometimes the bugs are there, sometimes not. And what I say to myself every time I go out hex fishing is be prepared for fickle behavior. Be prepared to be disappointed, either by the hex or by the fish. Be prepared for that. And it happens in so many ways. Some nights, even after the hatch is underway, there'll be no bugs. The same place where I saw thousands of bugs the night before, nothing. Other nights, there'll be an emergence and duns on the water, or there'll be a spinner fall, and there'll be no fish rising to them. Or I'll be on a stretch of river, and duns will start to come off on a perfect feeding setup, and no fish will touch them. I'll never see a fish. And my friend is 200 yards downstream through a tag alder tunnel and has the greatest fishing he or she has ever had. And so just short geographic distances will produce a totally different experience. Your friend will say, I had a great hex hatch, and you didn't see a thing, or vice versa. Yeah. And then there's even a more perplexing phenomenon. I don't pretend to be able to explain it, but oftentimes early in the evening, there'll be some smaller flies, little caddis or little mayflies that are out. Sometimes a lot of little small blue and olives might be out, and some decent fish might start feeding on them, and then the hex start. And for reasons that I can't even begin to explain, those darn fish will stay on those little flies and ignore these big hex mayflies floating by them, even though the hex must have 100 times as many calories as any one of those little smaller flies. So things can get weird.
Yeah, I guess. When do you, after the sun is set, how long do you wait for the hex hatch before you, pack it up and hike out?
You start thinking about that beer back at the truck? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I typically will stay until about 10:30 if nothing is happening. Sometimes it will be very, very slow, and yet a big fish might not show himself till later. I was fishing on my little home waters of Black Earth Creek a couple years ago, and nothing had happened. It was dead, dead, dead. I saw one or two flies, and I thought it was just hopeless. And finally, about 10:15, I said, well, that's it for the night, and I started to walk back to find the people I was fishing with downstream, and there was one big rise out in this pool, and I unhitched my fly, made one cast and dropped it out there, bam, an explosive hit, and a 22-inch brown, so that made it a great night. So you never know when to give up. In Michigan, because those guys have a lot more stamina, at least in everything, football. Sorry, Michigan people. But those guys will stay out for a little bit later hatch, a spinner fall that might happen at 1 or 2 a.m. in the morning. But that gets difficult for people who are working and have other kind of lives to lead. But that's a choice that each individual has to make based on their own schedule. You know, it turns out that when the hatch first starts in early June or whenever it starts in your area, there may be a day or two where the fish just ignore the flies. They're not aware of them, or they don't recognize the silhouette. And it takes a day or two for them to get used to it and lock in. But that first week after that can provide absolutely some of the best fishing that you can have. After the first week, my experience has been that spinners are typically more useful for fishing. And the fish can become quite selective and fussy as the days move on. But I would say that even though the hatch in your waters in Michigan, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and other places as well, the hatch might be 2 or 3 weeks, I have found that it can be fishable sometimes for weeks and weeks after the hatch has stopped, because they've been imprinted with the recognition of those big bugs, and I might fish all evening blind fishing, but pick up one or two good fish long after the hatch has happened.
I'm kind of curious, because of the darkness, how important is to match the hatch, so to speak? Is it just more of a silhouette you're trying to do in the right size?
Yep.
And how do you separate yours from the thousands of naturals that are potentially going by?
They're a good question. And here's the other thing, that the hatch might be really short-lived. It can be anywhere from 15 minutes to more than an hour. But when you stop and think of the size of the food, and you catch a fish, and hecks are literally stuffing its belly and hanging out of its mouth, the fish can become sated quite quickly and stop feeding. So your window of opportunity can be fairly short.
That's when you're trying to tie that fly on, right?
Right. But you have to be prepared to try both dead drift techniques and also twitching techniques. If you watch the flies, whether they're the emergers, some of the emergers are really struggling and making a big to-do on the water to get out of the nymphal shuck. Others are just kind of drifting along. Same thing for the duns. Some are just perfect little sailboats, big sailboats in this case, floating down the water until they start planning to lift off the water. Others are moving all around and twitching and are sideways. And then the spinners, they can do all kinds of things. They can be dead drift, or they can be twitching a whole lot on the water. So you want to be prepared, if fish aren't taking your fly on a dead drift, to move to a slight twitching, not over twitching, but a slight movement presentation. In these really heavy spinner falls, for example, and this gets right to your question, where if you take a flashlight out and shine it down on the water, you might be looking at more than a dozen flies per square foot of these massive flies. It's just an absolute conveyor belt of food. And your fly is lost in amongst those hundreds and hundreds of flies. You can try to time the cast and the arrival of the fly to a rising fish. Oftentimes you'll see them come up and take a natural right next to yours. You can try twitching and a little bit of movement. But if none of that works and the feeding activity is continuing, then you might want to think about trying something different, sometimes even outlandish. I've got a friend, Henry Hougley, who ties a fly he calls the baseball, which looks like a baseball. It's a whole bunch of spun deer hair on a fly, on a hook, and it just doesn't look like anything except maybe a mouse or a floating baseball. And he'll throw that out there. I often use a big Madam X. I might go to a size 4 Madam X. Another friend of mine fishes with something that correlates with a big black trude, just presenting that silhouette. But showing them something really different from what they're looking at with these hundreds of flies floating along on the water.
That can make the difference, yeah. Here's an FYI from Larry Hull in Michigan. He says, with daylight savings time, Michigan anglers stay out until 11:30 p.m. So, we have to calculate in the time difference and the stamina of the Michigan fly fishers, of course.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, well, you kind of answered part of my next question, which was, you know, specific presentations you use. So pretty much, you know, you're doing all dry fly fishing and you're doing twitching and dead drift floats past these fish. Is there any other things in the presentation area that we haven't covered that you want to talk about?
Well, in terms of your presentation angle, which you want to think about, if you suddenly wind up in a pool with three or four really big fish simultaneously feeding, you might want to work on one fish where you're casting 20 feet quartering upstream. Another fish is a sidearm cast underneath some brush close to the bank directly across from you. And a fish feeding down below you, maybe you don't want to move. You try a downstream presentation, a parachute bend, and just kind of feed it to them. But remember, most of these are short line presentations. So even though you're changing your angle of presentation, there's probably not more than 25 feet of line out.
Yeah. So, okay, good. Now, let's say we get lucky, or we're such a good fly fisher that we hook, you know, based upon our expertise, we hook up. What tips can you give about, you know, fighting and landing a fish, you know, a 20, 22-inch brown the dead of night without losing your life in the brush somewhere?
Well, don't get excited.
Don't get excited. Okay.
Your heart is beating. Right. You're sweating. You think you're having atrial fibrillations, blah, blah, blah. Well, once you've hooked up, and you know instantly, I mean, with a good fish, you know you've got a good fish. But success goes back to preparation. When you've scouted the area, when you've gotten to the pool to fish later on, you already have thought about where the sheltering lies are for that fish, where he's going to go when he moves from a feeding lie where he might be a little bit more exposed, and he's going to try to get back to safety. And invariably, it's back under a log or a snag, way underneath some vegetation, a deep undercut bank where who knows what might be down there. And if he is successful or she is successful on their first run, it's probably over for you. So that's one reason for having the heavy tippet. You want to be able to stop them from getting back deep into that sheltering lie where there's vegetation and other things that are simply going to cause you not to catch that fish. Now, sometimes, not a darn thing you can do about it. I was coming out of the Bibbin Swamp with a friend in a canoe. I was up in the front of the canoe. Been a pretty slow evening for me, but a great evening for him. And we were just watching. There was a humongous rise at about midnight as we were canoeing out. And I dropped my fly 10 feet away, and that fish just nailed it. But it didn't take 2 seconds from the time he hit, and I set up and felt as a really good fish where he was buried in a bunch of logs, and it was over. So you try to anticipate as much as you can, but you are going to lose some fish, just like you're going to occasionally lose a fly and have to go through the rigors of tying back on again. Then let's assume you've stopped them on that first run. It's a good fish. You might be in for, if you're an experienced angler, 3 to 5 minute fight. I put a lot of side pressure on a fish. It's almost, you know, you fish for tarpon. I'm sure some of our other listeners have. You put some hurt on the fish after you stop them on that first run, lateral pressure, turn them over again. Try to pull up against the direction that he's pulling to turn them over. And if you do that 2 or 3 or 4 times, you'll feel him start to give and move towards you. And your reel is nothing more than a storage system, although I like to get them onto the reel as quickly as possible so I'm not tripping over line or having things happen with my line floating in the water that are lead to an unhappy result. And so then it just becomes a question of either lifting your rod up slowly and being able to get your net underneath him, taking him head first if you can, or if you're up on the shore, to find a low, silty bank where you can just slide him up gently. And at that point, it's a question. It's hard to take photographs at night, but if you can just gently get your hook out quickly, wash them down a little bit, and take a real quick picture and get them back in the water so you don't take these wonderful fish and kill them in the process of our sport, That makes a perfect situation. I have one little story on this that might resonate. I'd been fishing up on the northwestern Wisconsin River, and a friend of mine had been upstream, caught several big fish, and I had flies coming down and absolutely nothing eating them. But I heard a commotion about 100 yards down below me, and I went down the middle of this river about chest high, going slowly, and finally I was in position, probably 20 feet away from four or five really big fish rising. And just at that moment, and this is bear country and deer country, there's all kinds of noises all around you in the woods, three sandhill cranes exploded from about a foot away from me, and it took a while to get my heartbeat back. But after that little excitement, the fish continued to feed. I put a fly out, and I hooked a good fish and did just what I said in terms of holding him sideways, side pressure, pulled him right in. First fish was 23 inches, which is a trophy brown by most measures.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. We've got a question in here from Dean.
I was just going to say how I was unhooking him. The other fish kept feeding, and I took the fish right out of his mouth and flipped it right back out and got another 22.5-inch fish on the next catch.
Oh, gosh.
You can have this goofy kind of stuff that happens after 2 or 3 days where you're despondent.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, that sounds like a great experience. Dean, up in Westford, Massachusetts, just asked a question on the Internet here. He says, have you found that keeping your headlamp on and aimed at the water to see your fly spooks the fish?
Yes. I don't shine all the lights I carry, headlights and chest lights and pocket lights. I don't shine them on the water except in that instance where I'm not certain whether or not there's any spinners on the water. And there I'll just shine it very carefully behind me, between me and the bank, and I'll try to be as subtle as I can. But a bright headlamp is not good. That will put the fish off as abnormal. Now, a lot of the headlamps we buy have a little red light alternative that you can use. And if that's sufficient for you to see, you can make that work. And I often will shine a pretty powerful light that I carry up into the sky, because even though I haven't felt any bugs hitting me, every once in a while there'll be a huge spinner flight that's up a ways, and you're not aware of it unless you see the silhouettes going by in a light. So a mix of lights, and be careful with light on the water, unless you're in a situation where you're just gathering information that will lead to helping you choose what fly to put on.
Okay, well, good, good. Well, if I don't see any more questions. Oh, hold it. Here's come something on the Internet. Okay, Wayne in Elmhurst, not sure where what state Elmhurst is in. Says, I often fish my northern Wisconsin lake in a bay that was 5 to 8 feet deep in late May or early June. Just at dusk, fish start jumping all around the boat. I don't see insects on the water, but I feel it must be some kind of hatch on. I find hex at this time of year all over my boathouse. Is this a hatch, and would I use an emerger pattern to catch them?
The answer is yes, and it's probably Elmhurst, Illinois, and somebody who drives 5 or 6 hours up to northern Wisconsin.
Oh, okay, okay.
You'll see the hex bugs on lighted walls, underneath any light porches. You've got out spider webs, so you know the bugs are hatching. And I've had the experience of being out on what we call the Sylvania Wilderness area up on the Michigan-Wisconsin border. And suddenly it's getting dark, and there's something skittering around and moving on the water, but you can't see very well. But they are hex, and those smallmouth bass just come up and murder them. And so you can put on a big hex dun. You can put on a merger, a hackle fly. In lakes, I think it helps to move them a little bit, to get a little bit of activity. But almost any fish that resides in a place where there are hexagenia will not miss that feast.
Yeah, yeah, good. Well, I hope that was helpful to Wayne. And that about does it. I don't see any more questions coming in here, so I guess we'll wrap things up a little bit early, about 10 minutes early, which is fine. And so did you want to have say anything in closing, Steve, before we move on to our prize giving?
I think the only thing I'd say, Roger, is try to encourage people to give it a try. It sounds crazy. For some,
it is crazy, Steve. It is crazy.
And for some, you'll never want to do it again. You know, you get away from the artistic aspect of watching your tight loop go back and forth, all the visual cues that come with fly fishing, and there's some meaner-spirited aspects of it. But as you get a chance to just experience the nightfall, experience the night, and the literally orgy of feeding that takes place when the hatch happens or the spinnerfall happens, and you learn how to approach that, prepare yourself, and have a little success, you'll never forget it, and you might even regress to become a hex addict and find yourself out there night after night.
Yeah, wifeless or husbandless or whatever the consequences are that might happen after that event. Yeah, well, good. Well, thanks so much, and stick with us here, Steve, because we're going to give away your book and some other prizes here, and I'll need your help to do that. So we're going to be giving away a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal and a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and Steve's book, Exploring Wisconsin Trout Streams, An Angler's Guide, courtesy of the University of Wisconsin Press. So stick with us here just a few minutes longer, and we'll give those prizes away. Reeling and Healing Midwest is a nonprofit organization that champions the fly fishing retreats for women surviving and battling all types of cancer. Their mission is to introduce women to the healing powers of the sport of fly fishing and provide a one-of-a-kind experience on and off the water. This is accomplished through the elements of fly fishing, positive camaraderie, peer coaching, nature and support network, which in turn renews the spirit and hope of each participant. Reeling and Healing Midwest is in need of trout flies, waders, leaders, fishing equipment, and other items. To view their current wish list and to learn how you can help support their retreats, visit www.reelingandhealingmidwest.org. That's reelingandhealingmidwest.org, or you can call them at 866-237-5725. That's 866-237-5725. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on that link, leave your comments, and we really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away our prizes, and the winners of our drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but do so for the next show so you have a good chance at winning one of these great prizes. And if you do win, we'll contact you after the show and provide you with information on how you're going to receive that gift. So let me get my computer fired up here and make a selection. And the first thing that we're going to give away is that one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. If you're not a member and if you don't win tonight, go to fedflyfishers.org. Fedflyfishers.org. Learn about the organization and join because it's a great organization to be part of. Our winner for that is Nate Gruber in Wisconsin. So we got a Wisconsin guy there. Okay. So congratulations, Nate, and I know you'll enjoy your membership and all the things that come with it. Now we'll give away that Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, a one-year subscription to that, courtesy of Amato Books. If you want to find out more about what Amato Books has to offer in the way of books and publications, just go to amatobooks.com. And I'll be, but we've got another Wisconsin resident here, Kurt Osterby. Kurt Osterby in Wisconsin. The wins are one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So congratulations, Kurt, and all people in Wisconsin who seem to be the big winners tonight. All right. So now we give away Steve's book, Exploring Wisconsin Trout Streams, Angler's Guide, courtesy of University of Wisconsin Press. So let me clear my cue here, and then we got a question here. And, Steve, you're going to help me with this and make sure that we get the right answer to this. Name two of the common names that Steve gave to the hex at the beginning of the show. Two of the common names. He listed about six, I think. But all I want is two. So if you can name those two, you just got yourself a book. So, Steve, I'm just refreshing here my cue and looking for somebody that paid attention and took notes. Uh-oh. We might have one of those classes out there where nobody was taking notes. Well, this is only one answer, so this isn't going to qualify one of two, but we got one that says fly fish wiggler. Was that one of them?
A wiggler would be a common name for the nymph, but that's not one of the things I mentioned when we were talking
about flies. And Dick, now we didn't want the Hexagena limbata name. Now, I'm talking about common names that Steve had given him. Okay, here's one. Big yellow mayfly and fish fly.
Yep, those are two of them.
Those are two of them? Then yep. David in Wilhelm in Minneapolis, you just got yourself a book, and Exploring Wisconsin Trout Streams by Angler's Guide, and you're right next door to Wisconsin, so this will be very handy to you. So good. Congratulations. And David, if you'll please send me your address so that you can do it in the same text box or send it to info@askaboutflyfishing.com. We'll get your address and we'll get that book sent out to you. So congratulations. And I guess that was a little tougher question than I had thought. So, but you got it. Well, anyway, Steve, hey, thanks so much for being on the show again tonight. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. And I want to wish you all the luck in your quest for the elusive permit.
Well, thank you very much. Maybe we'll see you astream one dark night chasing the heck.
Yeah. I'll be sure to bring my extra two lights, too, that's for sure.
Okay.
Well, hopefully you've all found our archive on our website. If you haven't yet, there's a couple of links on our homepage and links at the bottom of every page to the archive. Go out there and take a look at our past shows. We've done, I think, over 180 shows now or something. Hard to believe, but quite the archive. We've covered almost everything, but there's always something new to talk about, and for instance, tonight, the hex, which was a nice change of pace. So go out there, search. You can search by type of fish, type, you know, name of a river, nymphing techniques, all kinds of things, and explore it. I'm sure you'll be pleasantly surprised. Our next broadcast is going to be on December 4th at 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern, and then on that show, we're going to interview Terry Gunn, and our topic for the show will be tackling tailwaters. Terry lives and guides in one of the most beautiful tailwaters in the world, at Lee's Ferry, out in the Colorado River, the headwaters, or the head of the Grand Canyon. And tailwaters provide exceptional fishing, and knowing how to fish them can make or break your day. So listen in and learn Terry's secrets to getting the most out of your day on a tailwater. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Front Range Anglers, Housatonic River Outfitters, and Power Fibers Online Magazine for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.